This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk with tech guru Tim O'Reilly about social media services like Twitter and Facebook. But first, one of the mysteries of astrophysics is that the universe is expanding faster and faster. You know, we always thought that after the initial rush outwards from the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe should gradually slow down, braked by the force of gravity pulling matter inwards. So for the rate of expansion to be increasing, some other force must be acting, countering gravity and pushing the universe outwards. And scientists have called that mysterious force dark energy. Several years ago, researchers were able to put the first numbers to that dark energy by observing the movement of distant supernova. Now, using different techniques, different tools, and looking at different objects, astronomers have been able to confirm the presence of dark energy in the universe, and their findings mesh nicely with the previous supernova-based data. They always like it when that happens. Joining me to talk about it is William Forman. He's an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me this afternoon, and thanks for inviting me to represent our group.
You're welcome. Was I going overboard when I said physicists are always happy when they get those numbers to match up?
I think we're always happy. Well, sometimes people are happy when they make a new discovery and find that something doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that a little bit as we go.
Okay, let's talk about dark energy again. How was it originally discovered?
I mean, originally the discovery, as you mentioned, was through the study of distant galaxies, and people used supernovae in those galaxies to measure their distances. They had built on previous work that used a particular kind of supernova that people thought was a standard candle, a well-known absolute brightness. And what they did was to measure the apparent brightness, how bright it appeared, and if they knew absolutely how bright it was, they could determine how far away it was. And if you combine that with the redshift of the host galaxy in which the supernova was found, you can then determine the shift of the spectral lines from its stars, and then these two teams were able to determine the expansion rate of the universe as a function of time. And as you mentioned, they found out that, in fact, rather than slowing under the force of gravity, as everyone had really expected, the universe was really accelerating.
Mm-hmm. So what did your group do differently than using the supernovae as candles?
So this is a very, very different kind of measurement. The previous measurements, supernovae and several others, had all studied the geometry using distance to measure the expansion and how the expansion was behaving. And this was a very, very different experiment that we did with that we had performed. And what we did was we studied the growth of structure in the universe, and it sounds a little complicated, but basically we were measuring the competition between gravity's pull and the accelerated expansion. What we did was to study clusters of galaxies, the largest collapsed objects that we know about in the universe, several hundreds of galaxies together, and we measured this competition on a new scale, about 100 million light years. And the observatory that we worked with is the Chandra X-ray satellite, and we study these masses of clusters as they appear about 5 billion light years, as these clusters of galaxies about 5 billion light years away, and they were for about 5 billion light years before the present. And the goal was to compare the masses, the weight of these clusters as they appeared about 5 billion years ago and as they appear at the present. So we could actually measure this competition between the expansion and the effects of gravity.
And so it bore out the effects that there was the dark energy there.
And so that's exactly what happened. What we found is that as you go from 5 billion years ago to the present, you expect if there was no dark energy, you expect a certain growth. And in fact, there was five times less growth. Mm-hmm. So these clusters of galaxies were much less massive than we expected by a factor of five. And what's particularly nice about the study that we were able to do is that the X-rays are really uniquely suited to doing this kind of work. Most of the normal matter in clusters is hot, and it radiates in the X-rays. And the clusters are bright, so you can see them far away, so it's relatively straightforward to study them at these relatively large distances. Mm-hmm. But what was really nice about the clusters is that they're especially sensitive to this competition between the acceleration and gravity. And it's sort of a little bit like the canary in the coal mine. The cluster growth, when the most of the growth of clusters is actually happening, is just when the supernova had predicted the effects of the dark energy was becoming important. about 7 billion years ago. So the clusters were like these canaries just sitting there growing just at the time when the expansion was just taking off.
Well, let me ask the two obvious questions then. One is confirming that there is this dark energy. Number one, do we know why it kicks in about 7 billion years ago? And two, does it bring us any closer to knowing just what it is?
So I think we certainly don't really know what it is, and we can talk about that a little bit more. As far as kicking in, you know, at a certain time, as the universe is expanding, its density is decreasing. And in one of the models, if you think about Einstein's general theory of relativity, there was a place in there for a cosmological constant. So as the density of the universe falls, when that cosmological constant becomes important, that's when the growth would start. So I don't think anybody would be able to predict that it would happen at, you know, 7 billion years in the past. But, you know, it might happen somewhere, and that is where it just happened to occur.
Mm-hmm. And as far as knowing anything more about what it is?
So as far as what it is, it's a little bit, you know, uncertain. Basically, I think people don't know. I mean, there are two basic, you know, possibilities. The one is that, you know, Einstein is correct, and that this stuff that we see, this dark energy, this drives the acceleration, is what Einstein allowed for in his equations, this cosmological constant. And, you know, it's just called this dark energy. It's a cosmological constant because it's constant with time. It doesn't change with time.
Mm-hmm.
And if Einstein is right, then this acceleration would make up about 70%, 72% of all the matter and energy in the universe. It's much more common, much more important than all the stuff that we're made out of. So that's one possibility. If you think about particle physics, the particle physicists would tell you that even empty space has some energy associated with it. And so this could be the cause of the acceleration, energy and mass associated with empty space. And the other possibility is, in fact, that Einstein is wrong, and that general relativity, although it does work over many, many different environments, does in fact break down when you get onto scales on the size of the universe. So it could be something associated with Einstein's theory in particle physics and the properties of empty space, or it could be something totally new that we know nothing about.
Does it tell us anything more about how the universe will end?
Well, certainly it gives us a hint.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have some measure of the magnitude of this dark energy, and you can think about it as a spring. Springs embedded in space, and you know, the stiffness of the spring, how much it's pushing, we've now sort of gotten a handle on, and so we have a prediction. We can make some estimates of how the universe will now evolve, and so based on what we know now, it certainly looks like that things that are already collapsed, things that are already bound, Earth, our solar system, our own galaxy, those are going to stay pretty much as we see them. There's another nearby galaxy some of your listeners perhaps have heard of. It's called M31, Andromeda Galaxy. You can see it on a nice clear night at the right time of year. And it's very likely that we're bound to that galaxy and that we will eventually merge. But objects that are much further away, a little bit further away, the nearest big cluster to us is the Virgo cluster. That cluster is actually going to eventually, in a few more, in about twice the age of the present universe, that's going to actually recede and become invisible to us.
Not something we have to worry about in the near future.
Not something that we have to worry about in the immediate near future, no.
So where do you go from here?
Well, I think where we go from here is there are ongoing studies, certainly, from the ground. There are plans from space to do much more detailed studies. Currently, the models that people have made have been able to test, mostly assume that this cosmological constant doesn't change very rapidly or in a complex way over time. And so what one would like to be able to do is to have enough observations that you can actually map in great detail and with great precision how the universe expands over time. And that would allow you to really test in a much more critical way both Einstein's cosmological constant and also whatever other models people propose.
If Einstein is wrong, does that mean we have to throw away physics as we know it?
So just as, you know, Einstein modified Newton a little bit So someone will modify, you know, Einstein's theory a little bit, presumably. You know, Einstein's theory applies to a huge variety of different phenomena. You actually use it when every time you use your GPS, there are, you know, general relativistic corrections that are needed. So it does work, you know, on scales, on the size of the Earth, on the size of the galaxies, you know, to really quite great precision. But it may be breaking down, there may be small corrections needed to make it apply to the universe as a whole.
Well, Einstein looked at the universe as sort of geometric, you know, gravity being geometric. Did he look at the constant that way, too? And would that mean we have to modify the geometry sort of
so
view of it?
Exactly what you say is exactly correct, that, you know, Einstein's theory was a geometric theory of gravity, and he compared the geometry of space with the matter and energy that was in it. And when he initially proposed his general theory of relativity, he wanted to try to make the universe static. And he had to put this extra cosmological constant in without any other real motivation. And he then thought that was perhaps one of his blunders, because he was later found out that, in fact, the universe was really expanding. So when he put it in on one side of the equation, but now particle physicists would like to put it on the other side, and that's where it becomes the energy density associated with the vacuum. So it's a slight modification to what Einstein put in, but still completely consistent with his concept of you know, space-time.
Dr. Forman, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. William Forman, astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, confirming the presence of dark energy. Still don't know what it is, but it is truly an exciting kind of thing to think about, and the fact that maybe Einstein's theory may have to be modified a little bit. Maybe not. We'll see what happens as this pans out over the years. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about the future of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all those social communities with Tim O'Reilly, who's written all kinds of journals and articles and the guru of all this kind of stuff. You get to ask him questions, and we'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Are you a fan of Barack Obama on Facebook? Almost 3.5 million people are. Or maybe you're one of the 23,000 people who follow Al Gore on Twitter, signing on to get updates on his doings. Or maybe you're a content provider sending your videos to YouTube and your photos to Flickr. Or perhaps you're listening to Science Friday right now, or your avatar is in Second Life. Or maybe you're Twittering us right now at SciFry as we talk about this whole new world of social communities. From the elections to hurricane recovery efforts, 2008 was really a big year for social media online, and joining me now is one of the biggest proponents of interaction and interconnection, Tim O'Reilly. He's founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. You might know them from the Line Art Animal computer books or their magazines such as Make and Craft, or you might know Tim from Twitter, as some 19,000 people do. They're Twitter partners with him. Welcome to the program, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
You're credited with the invention of the word Web 2.0, correct?
Close enough. It was actually somebody in my company who came up with the term, but it was really around a set of ideas that I had been talking about. So,
what does it actually mean?
Well, for us, it was there's two separate aspects to it. There's the core of the concept and the name. The name was simply a reflection that everybody thought the web was dead after the dot-com bust. And we were taking a strong position saying, no, the web will be back, and there's a second coming of the web. So the two was not a new version of the web. It was really just it's back. Mm-hmm. And the essence of what we were arguing was that the thing that distinguished companies that survived the dot-com bust and the whole new breed of companies that were coming up was that they really understood how to harness the power of network effects. You know, if the network was becoming the platform for the computer industry, understanding how users add value was the very essence of success. And we looked at that at companies from Google to Amazon to eBay who were the survivors of the first generation, and then new companies coming up like YouTube or Wikipedia or MySpace and Facebook, now Twitter. These are all explorations of the power of connecting people over the internet in new ways and deriving value from them.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the shortest definition I have is it's the design of systems that get better the more people use them.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Tim O'Reilly. So are we going to eventually forget, so to speak, that there is an internet and then just use these social communities and new products as they come out?
Well, there's two kinds of social media, and a lot of people focus very much on the explicit use of social media. In the last year, I think there's been a huge amount of focus on Facebook, for example, and now Twitter. But it's really important to understand that social media is not just when people explicitly share information about themselves online. It's how companies are able to mine data about people's implicit behavior. The real breakthrough of Google, for example, was to realize that there was a kind of social graph that they could exploit in the way people link from one site to another that would enable them to give better search results. Mm-hmm. And so people don't think of Google as a social media company, and yet it is. Another great example, you probably saw their recently introduced Google mobile app with this voice-activated search.
Right.
Well, and you think about that. Well, what's going on there? They actually built their speech database with a service called Google 411, which allowed them to collect millions of samples of people giving common searches in many, many accents, many, many vocal styles. And then they're able then to apply that and match it to this other user-generated database, what John Battelle in his book The Search called the Database of Intentions, this huge database they have of all the things that people search for. So both of those applications are actually user-generated content used to build a huge database that allows them to do things that you just couldn't really do before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in future we're going to see new kinds of applications that are driven by socially created databases, but not necessarily explicitly social. Similarly, you don't think of Wikipedia as sort of a social application, and yet obviously it is. It's socially created reference and increasingly socially created news.
Mm-hmm.
Or take MyBarackObama.com, an incredibly powerful social app, both for fundraising, but also you probably heard about their Houdini project, literally where they were crossing people off the voter rolls in real time, poll observers in particularly in contested precincts were reporting in. Oh, this person just signed in, and then they would disappear from the lists of people who were to be called in the Get Out the Vote efforts. Amazing integration, all the way down from people calling in data from cell phones, and turnaround of about a half hour, to get people off of the calling lists.
Yeah, well, is it possible to predict where any of this is going?
Well, I think you can see a deep long-term trend. It's very hard to predict details,
mm-hmm.
But you can certainly see the shape of the future. I first started talking about this idea that the network was the platform, it was really about collaboration, was the really important thing to be paying attention to. Back probably about 1997, I gave my first talk on that topic. So it's really the trend was apparent 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did that mean that I was able to predict YouTube? No. I didn't even think about, there'd be this amazing opportunity where people would be, they'd create this viral embed code so people could put video anywhere. Because there were a whole lot of things that bold innovations there. Somebody said, okay, we're going to take the cost of streaming all that video, but we're not going to build it as a central portal. We're going to let you put it out on your own site because virality and the social spread of this stuff is more important than having everybody come to us.
Mm-hmm.
That was a change in mindset. People gradually learn the new medium, and they get more and more comfortable with it. And I think we're going to see that increasingly. I think some of the big changes ahead for us are around the telephone. the mobile phone driving the front of innovation. So again, thinking about something like Twitter, how integrated it is with updates from SMS. When you look at what happened with the Mumbai terrorist attacks, how many of the updates on Twitter were sent in from mobile phones to make kind of a real-time news feed? That phone is becoming a sensor that's driving a collective application. Well, there's going to be a lot more examples of that.
I find that Twitter, in my experiences, is almost an older generation of people, or more than younger people who are using it. Do you find that true?
I guess I haven't really thought about it that way. I was laughing because I saw there was one 10-year-old kid who, self-professed 10-year-old kid who had posted a blog, has a blog about Twitter etiquette and how to be effective on Twitter. So I haven't actually done any demographic studies.
1-800-998-2255, talking with Tim O'Reilly, who is founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. Let's go to the phones. Deborah in Old Hickory, Tennessee.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Well, I've just recently become an addict of Facebook, and I joined a while ago, but didn't really get into it, and I thought, well, it's really more for college kids and that kind of thing. And I thought, I'm almost 50, and I thought, oh boy, I'm skewing the age here up. And the more I got into it and started kind of mining all these friends I was reconnecting with from college and high school and where I work and all that, I then started mining and realized I want to know what the people I care about are doing.
Yeah.
So I'm friends with like BJ Lederman and Deborah Amos and Madeline Brand, and it's just really interesting to get not so an intimate picture of people, but you really kind of get to see their values and.
Well, let me ask you this question,
really,
Deborah. If Deborah Amos says, "I'm taking a shower now,"
uh-huh.
or anybody else, Mossberger in the Wall Street Journal, you can join his Facebook and he'll say, "I'm driving my car."
Mm-hmm.
Why do you care about that?
Well, something like that. I don't generally.
Well, can I answer that?
Sure.
There's two kinds of people that you follow on Twitter. There are people that you don't know well. So for example, I'm followed by, it's now approaching 20,000 people. And they're probably not interested that I'm brushing my teeth. I do try to mix in some personal details, but mostly people follow me because I Twitter what I'm reading or thinking about than because I'm Twittering personal details. But once they start following me, they're interested to know that, that I split wood, that I make jam, that I go out for a walk with my family saw this amazing sunset, because it creates sort of a more personal connection. But there's also a small number of people who I follow. Now, first of all, I follow a group of people, again, who are my eyes and ears to give me intelligence about interesting areas. So I follow people in the financial community, the alternative energy community, the technical community, and that's where I get the stream of data that I pass on to my followers. But I also follow my family. And I see, for example, my wife's reaction to something we just did together, or I'm at the office and she tweets something that she did. Now, she only has a dozen followers, and they're all close friends. And it does create what Lisa, I forget her last name, at Lisa, called ambient intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
I know more about my brother, for example, who I'm still quite close with, but there's little details that he'll put in Twitter, that his daughter who plays lacrosse in college has come home and they're working out together.
Why wouldn't he just email that to you?
Well, because with Twitter, it's sort of broadcast to a bunch of people at once, and it's just a very lightweight mechanism. And it's also something that's very unimposing. If you miss it, you don't worry about it.
Right. 1-800-98.
Email is much more point to point.
Let me see if I can get some more questions in, Tim. Jeffrey in Washington. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Tim. I'm the director of web communications for the Environmental Protection Agency, and
right,
I follow you in Twitter actually, and a whole bunch of other people. So I'm kind of curious where you see social media and government going, particularly for policy setting. I'm pretty familiar with the communications end, and we're starting to investigate how to use some of these things to set policy, to do a regulatory process, that sort of thing. I'd be curious to hear your comments.
Well, I think certainly it's a great mechanism for doing quick polls. Now, to be sure, they're self-selected, but you can kind of get the sort of the ambient temperature around an issue, particularly if you have a reasonable number of followers. But even if you don't, you can often engage with somebody who does. You know, I'm really thinking, for example, of at Scott Monty at Ford, who reached out to me, and I had critiqued something that he had said, and now he kind of tries to include me because he knows that, you know, if he says something important, I will pass it on to my followers. So he gets a much bigger, base of people to reach out to and ask questions of. And I think it's still an evolving medium, but that's probably the most important thing you can do is to engage. It's a conversation. You know, this goes back to the Kluetrain manifesto at the beginning of the social media revolution, where it opens with the line, markets are conversations.
Let me just give it an idea here. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Tim O'Reilly. Go ahead, Tim.
By the way, I should say I'm at Tim O'Reilly on Twitter.
There you go.
In case anybody wants to follow me
or Twitter. Jeffrey, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Are you part of the change.gov's website, or are you collecting data to become better at the EPA? What is your intent on changing your website?
Well, we're investing in all kinds of different social media. We have a blog. We're looking into podcasts. We're looking for the first way to really use this stuff to set some policy. Change.gov is completely the Obama transition team. It's not any part of the federal government.
Has the word gone down from the transition team to change? To become more interactive?
I'm on something called the Federal Web Managers Council, which is all the cabinet agencies and departments and several other agencies, and we're writing documents that we're trying to pass along. So actually there's a very large and active group within the federal government already looking into this stuff. We're very excited about what I think the Obama administration will mean for using these tools in government. There's some obstacles that we're looking for some help in solving, but I think that it's going to be a really good partnership as opposed to just top down.
Is there a Twitter we can follow what you're doing?
I'm on Twitter. I'm at levyj413, levyj413.
I didn't mean you personally, but that's okay. You'll get a few tweets now.
Yeah,
but I
yeah.
mean the government besides the change.com, other people, other sections of the government to follow.
Oh. Yes. Well, yeah, there's actually
yeah,
there's
it,
a very
is a
large
huge, a number
of
government,
government Twitters.
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, Jeffrey, send me an email, tim@o'reilly.com. I'd love to connect bit more deeply because I'm really interested in the use of government, the use of Twitter and other social media.
See, Tim, the old-fashioned way is still working through the radio.
No kidding.
All right. So it used to be SneakerNet, now it's RadioNet.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things that changed here, Ira, I think, is this sort of feeling of connection.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really nice about Twitter is the architecture of visibility. You know, with email, your emails are invisible to everyone until you give them, unless you reach out to them directly.
Right.
With Twitter, anybody can follow you. And this is one of the big changes. It was really introduced by Flickr, the photo sharing service, and has spread since then. But, this wonderful idea that you can follow somebody without their permission. And so you're really able to start casting a net. It recognizes that relationships are asymmetric in the real world, versus, Facebook or the like, which says, we have to acknowledge each other or we can't see each other.
Mm-hmm. Does it get to be a point where it becomes a distraction to your productivity, where you Tim O'Reilly, say, I better go Twitter this now because I have all this following and I'm getting if I get up to a million followers, they'll expect something every 10 minutes or that Twitters are coming in and you need to look at them all the time, or any one of us. I'm not, singling you out individually.
Yeah, it's a bit of an issue. I think it's pretty clear that there is the concept of Dunbar's number, the number of people that you can effectively, connect with. And certainly I'm above Dunbar's number on Twitter, and I can't keep up with everybody I'm following. But there also really is this feeling with Twitter that you don't have to keep up. Mm-hmm. It's just a river flowing by, and you can dip in when you want. And so I will definitely – there are days when I am just blasting the Twitter out because I'm at my desk, I'm reading, I'm thinking,
And it really is very easy to drop into Twitter, particularly with, I have a third-party client called Twirl that I use mostly because it is, it's an Adobe Air app. It sits with a sidebar. And, you know, so it doesn't have to really enter. I don't have to get out of my workflow very deeply.
All right. Tim, hang on to that thought because we have to take a break. But we'll get on the other side of the break and let maybe give you, you can give us some hints on how to Twitter and have more easily and have some other apps that'll help us. We're talking with Tim O'Reilly, who is, well, you know, all the O'Reilly Media founder and CEO. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My guest is Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. You can follow him on Twitter at Tim O'Reilly, and he's with us to talk about Twitter and other. Let's in the few minutes we have left, Tim, let's expand this a bit to talk about Facebook and Google have both put out services that will let you interact more with the services and connect one site to another. This seems to be finally bringing the walls down on some of these fenced-in communities.
I think that's absolutely in the future for social media. You know, if you think back on the history of email, in 1994, I published a book that was about how to, you know, figure out the addressing formats for different, for I guess it was several hundred different incompatible email systems. You know, and before long, everybody realized just how stupid this was. And we started to standardize and create gateways, and then bit by bit, everybody just adopted sort of the Internet RFC 822 style email. And I think the same thing is going to happen in social media. The value for users of having one interoperable social network is so great that it's very hard to believe that you're going to end up within the next year or two not having fairly complete interoperability and visibility across social networks.
You were talking before about platforms of the future. Are the iPhones of the world going to be taking place of our laptops and our cell phones and these multimedia platforms where you can instantly Twitter and tweet and do all kinds of stuff?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think we are definitely reaching the end of the personal computer era. That's not to say that personal computers won't be with us, and Apple shows a great way that you can make a mobile device work better if you actually have a PC as an intermediary. You know, if you look at iTunes, it's a control station that makes your phone better than if it's just connected directly to the cloud. But there's no question in my mind that the phone is the dominant platform for the next, and not just the phone even, but really other ubiquitous devices that take computing out into the world, is, but then are connected on the back end to various kinds of cloud services, is the future of computing.
I'm wondering why we don't see a portable keyboard app, you know, a little wireless app for the iPhone at this point where people can turn it.
Well, I think part of it is that the keyboard isn't necessarily going to be the dominant model. Again, something you can read into Twitter is that people figured out, oh, actually, you know, if a phone is all I've got, how do you build a service that turns that into a virtue?
Right.
And, so we started with SMS being, and I'll think of all the SMS-based services, particularly in other parts of the world, that are the dominant way of delivering computing now. And, we're starting to have viable speech recognition. I do think that there will be more keyboards, but I think it'll also mean that we'll move somewhat away from text as the primary, means of data entry.
Well, that Google search, the vocal Google search, I think shows exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The fact that you can get on there, and it's so accurate. You just try to fool it, and you can't fool it in many cases. Let me see if I can get one last question in from listeners before we have to say goodbye. Kevin in Mountain View. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Kevin Marks.
Hi, Tim. Glad to talk to you. I wanted to push back on when you said virality earlier. I think that's a really bad metaphor, trying to construct things as disease. We should be thinking about more organic metaphors like fruiting or reproduction rather than disease for these social things.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, although, I'm a big believer in language is like a river that finds its own course, and the term virality has come to be used in this way, and hey, guess what? There's a wonderful line from Shakespeare, the hot blood leaps over the cold decree. and it means what it means today.
Thanks, Kevin. One last question. Do you think that there are people who are fearful of all this knowledge about themselves leaking into that cloud out there? Is that justifiable?
There is definitely fear and there is risk. But there's a really great point that was made, I believe, by Joe Trippi when we had him on stage at our Web 2.0 summit back in November. He was talking about something that happened in politics where I forget the name of the fellow, but one of the senator fallen asleep in a hearing. And he lost his seat as a result. At least Trippi thought so. That was one of the factors because there was a YouTube video mm-hmm. of this event that was very, very widely distributed, used by his competition, and it played a role in his defeat. But as Joe said, look, this happens all the time. You know, these guys are up for 30 hours, and yes, they fall asleep. You know, so the first time it's caught on video, it's a sensation. The second time, a little less so. And eventually people go, oh, okay, yeah, that happens.
Right.
And I think you'll see things that were once sensational and created lots of attention in social media go, oh, okay, yeah, that happens. You know, somebody's outed on Facebook in some way, or people learn. First of all, they adapt their behavior to the new standards of visibility, but also people get used to it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for joining us, Tim. We'll give you some more time. We'd love to continue this conversation.
All right.
Thanks for coming on, and have a great holiday season.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media, and you can follow him on Twitter at Tim O'Reilly. For the rest of the hour, publication and interaction of a different sort in the world of scientific publishing. One of the ways scientists measure success, as you know, is publications. Publish or perish, you've heard of that. But it's not just how many publications you churn out. And in what journals, the actual measure of success of a paper is if other scientists find it interesting and useful, and they search for it and find it and use it. Useful enough to base further work upon it. So every paper cites work that it's based on or expanded on or it needs. And joining me now is David Pendlebury. He's a citation analyst with the scientific business of Thomson Reuters. The company keeps track of who's citing whom and how often. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Let's start by explaining what a citation is.
Well, that can be confusing. Some people refer to it as an entry on their curriculum vitae, but we use it to mean one of those footnotes or references that appears at the bottom of their research papers. And as you just mentioned, that is acknowledgement of an intellectual debt to someone else, sometimes to themselves.
Right.
Of a previous paper.
And if we look at citations now at the end of this year and we look back and see which papers and subjects were cited the most, let's talk about what you have found.
Well, I did look at papers published in 2008 and which ones were most cited. I went field by field because different fields have different average rates of citation. Neurosciences, molecular biology, and genetics have very high average rates of citations, but mathematics and pharmacology have lower rates of citation. So you have to do it on a field-by-field basis.
Okay.
Then you also have to consider that papers that were published earlier in the year have had more time to be cited than those published later in the year.
Right.
So adjusting to certain things, I did look through some main fields, biology, medicine, physics, and chemistry, and I tried to pick up on highly cited papers published in 2008. Now, the main or the key discoveries may not have been made in 2008. They may have been made in the previous few years, but the indication of the high citations is a signal.
And what did you find? Biology, for example.
Well, this field called cellular autophagy, for those of us who forgot our Greek or Latin, means self-digestion. It's also called autophagocytosis. And this is a reaction at the cellular level that actually takes the trash out when things degrade. It was formerly thought that this especially happens when organisms are under great stress and there is decay. But in 2006, some Japanese researchers found that this is a normal process that is actually essential to development and homeostasis or general health. So this has really ignited a great interest in this field. There was some recent work in yeast, but it has moved into eukaryotic cells. Mm-hmm. And now there's even a journal called Autophagy that is in its fourth volume. So wow. That's another marker of a field that is expanding mm-hmm. And is important as a specialty when a journal is founded on that field. But I looked at the field in general. Back a few years, there were about 200 papers published in this field in 2004, 300 in 2005, 500 in 2006, 700 in 2007, and almost 1,000 in 2008. So it's an exponential growth.
What about medicine? What did you find there?
In medicine, I chose induced pluripotent stem cells as the high-cited field, and there were certainly a number of papers that were from late 2007 and early 2008. After I sent you my list by email yesterday, I noticed that Science Magazine named this area the breakthrough area of 2008, and I thought that that was quite interesting that we both came to the same conclusion, but by different methods. Hmm. They surveyed their journalists who cover science day in and day out. They talked to their editorial boards and other people. So that was a form of peer review where the experts are giving their judgments.
Yeah. And then just to clarify, this is a field that it shows ways to generate stem cells with characteristics similar to embryonic stem cells, but without the ethical issues that are involved.
That's correct. They're generated from what is known as somatic or adult cells.
Right. Let's move on to physics. What have you got in physics?
Well, you could call this physics or you could call it chemistry, but it's graphene. Graphene is carbon molecules in a sort of honeycomb pattern that is one atom thick. It's the thinnest material known. The key papers were from a group at the University of Manchester in 2004 and 2005, but this field has really, again, exploded in terms of the number of papers published and the number of citations to those papers.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking about citations with David Pendlebury. So that would indicate this is a hot field of research.
Very hot.
One molecular layer thick sheets of graphite.
Correct.
Would that be nanoparticles, things like that? Or?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, if you imagine a sheet of graphene rolled into a tube, that's a nanotube.
So it's like chicken wire rolled up.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Just yesterday, IBM announced the fastest transistor yet made out of graphene materials.
Wow. So we'll even see more citations.
Absolutely.
Next year. Let's move on to chemistry.
Well, again, you might call this chemistry and you might call it physics, but there were papers published in 2008. This is a true 2008 discovery. They're iron-based superconductors, and this is very unusual because for the last 20 years or so, people have been exploring superconductors with copper materials, cuprate superconductors. So this gives researchers an entirely new family of superconducting compounds, and there's just great interest in the different properties of these particular new superconductors.
Any way to predict what's going to be hot paper next year?
Well, that's hard. We do some prediction in terms of who might win the Nobel Prize in the following years, but that's based on our view of what has been done in research and what has been cited.
How accurate have you been on that?
Been fairly accurate recently. Fortunately, of the four prizes that we survey in the science fields, we don't do literature and we don't mm-hmm. do peace, we got at least one person in three of the four prizes last year.
Wow. So can you tell us what would be hot next year? or you think it's going to be high next?
I wish I could. I wish I could.
Is there a modern classic of, if you look back 10 years, you'd find the most citations?
Yeah. It's interesting to note that most papers are cited moderately or very little. This is the 80-20 rule, where in the population, 20% of the population gets 80% of the citations. So papers that are cited 500, 1,000, 3,000 times are extremely rare, exotic papers. One that really stands out is the work on RNA interference by Mello and Fire, and they, in fact, received the Nobel Prize in 2006 for their work. So there's a strong correlation between citations in the literature and the authors of those papers, the highly cited papers, and who may win a Nobel Prize.
So you can do your own little office pool.
We can. I haven't started one yet. Maybe I should.
You get all those 10-year papers together and, you know, make the grid.
Yeah.
And figure out who's going to get next year's Nobel Prizes about this time.
Like the NCAA, right.
Exactly. And you get to choose that little box.
Yep.
And why leave it to sports? Why not have fun with science, though?
Well, in fact, the bookies Ladbrokes in England takes bets on the Nobel Prize, but only in literature and peace so far. They haven't moved into science yet.
We have to get into that popular culture.
If they do, I'll be there.
but people take this very seriously, though, too, don't they? Well, the citations.
Yes, absolutely, because citing in the sociology of science is really a very serious practice. It is actually malpractice if you do not cite relevant work regarding the paper that you're publishing. And it's the job of reviewers of scientific papers and editors to make sure that you have indeed cited the relevant literature before. It is science moves like law moves, based on precedent, and it's very important to acknowledge that precedent and to pay your intellectual debts.
There you have it. Could not have summed it up any better, David. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Happy holiday to you.
You too.
David Pendlebury is a citation analyst with the scientific business of Thomson Reuters, a very big publishing company. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Key Molesky. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us the classic old Mailway, we'd like to get those letters. Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Flora Lichtman has her sci-fi pick of the week up there. It's what happens if you take if you take eggnog and you want to make sure that it's, what if you spike it a little bit, will it kill any bad bugs in it? We went to the laboratory, did an experiment with it. You can see it on sciencefriday.com, our eggnog laboratory experiment on our pick of the week. Have a great holiday weekend, a Merry Christmas, happy holidays to you. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.